How would you like to create passive income with property rentals? Cameron Tope will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Cameron is he is an investor and the founder of Emerson Property Management. And he believes that landlords are running their rentals wrong and it's costing them more than they realize. And he's managing over 300 properties in Houston. And he also owns a portfolio of more than 30 rentals himself. And he focuses on turning underperforming properties into high-performing assets through better systems, better execution, and a more disciplined approach. Now, I would argue that if you can do that, then you're a really great asset to know. So, tell us about how does a landlord create property, a passive property income with property rentals?
Property Wealth Strategies podcast with Lily Patrashku shares world's most influential property investors, sharing their strategies for making money with property.
Well, Lily, thanks for having me on first and foremost. And yeah, I think the problem with rental properties is they're not really that passive. You know, passive income, everybody talks about mailbox money and making them passive, but you have to have some sort of system in place to be able to make them passive. If just putting a tenant in place and letting and thinking you're going to collect the money and everything's going to be great, that's going to result in evictions or lates or late fees or something that maybe is problematic with the tenant. Maintenance, you know, unlike fine wine, you know, maintenance doesn't get better with time. So if you let that stuff go, it could become a bigger problem. And I think the biggest thing as an individual person, I think creating wealth with one or two rental properties is still a phenomenal way, even in 2026 as asset prices have come up. But I think the first and foremost, what you have to do is create a system, have some sort of system down on how you're going to manage that property. And that will result, should result in more passive income.
Thank you. Tell us, how did you become a property genie yourself, like a great property manager?
Well, I think there are certain things like, you know, you can read books and you can try to understand. And when I was originally an engineer and I saw oil go up and then crash. And so all these guys were like in the office, there were people who were freaking out like me. I had $30,000-$40,000 of student loans. And there were some of these old timers who were just very, very Joe Cool, not stressed, not upset, not worried about getting laid off. And I was asking them why. And they're like, well, because I own five houses. And they had rent coming in every month. So that's where I was like, oh my gosh, this is something I need to get into. And I started reading, but I think really where I developed my expertise is doing it. Again, we can read books on how to ride a bike, but till you get out there and scrape your knees a few times, it's hard to get all the little intricacies. So I think a lot of it is, you know, learning by doing. And then obviously you have the training and education and the experience from having fantastic mentors that have hundreds or in some cases thousands of doors and being able to pick their brain and leverage that relationship with them to, you know, people that have gone and seen the things that I haven't seen yet at 1,000, 2,000 doors and being able to, you know, to have them help, you know, guide the path or say like, hey, you're gonna run into this problem at some point. So that's the other thing, having great people around me and then just, you know, hit my head off the wall too many times to count or more times than I can count.
Okay, so tell us your secret property system that any landlord can leverage in order to become, the kind of landlord that we all dream to be, a landlord that doesn't do a lot but makes all the money.
Yeah, I think the first thing, you know, there's so many intricacies into a full system. You know, we're managing about 300 properties across the greater Houston area, and I have a staff of a half a dozen folks that helps. But when you're starting out with just one or two, I think the biggest and best thing you can do is set the expectations up front with the tenant. So making sure that you're setting that relationship from the get-go that you're serious, this is a business. And that will help. If you treat this like a hobby, you're going to get burnt because people are going to take advantage of you or want you to do them favors. And you're their landlord. You've got all this money. You know, everybody thinks that as a landlord, you have endless pockets. But it's just one of those things that setting that expectation up front with the tenant, I think, usually results in, okay, they're not messing around. You know, Lily treats this like this property like a business. She's not treating this like a hobby. And I need to make sure I pay my rent on time, report maintenance, And then, so that would be number one. And number two is being responsive. I think making sure that you're getting back to a tenant when they need something, that you're making sure that when there was a maintenance item that comes in, that you're responding to it quickly. You have a good team of people that can respond and you know, address issues or problems. The worst thing, and like I mentioned, it just, things get worse. You know, if you don't respond to a tenant and they keep dragging along, now you might be looking at an eviction scenario. If a maintenance item, you're like, oh, I'm not too worried about that leak, I don't want to mess with that. Well, now it could become mold, or it could become some catastrophic problem. So I think that's the big thing, is setting expectations up front and making sure that you're responsive. If you do those two things, I think you're going to have a phenomenal experience. There's always things that could come up, but making sure you set expectations and making sure we're responsive, those would be the two easiest things that you can do and simplest things.
Thank you. I think one important aspect of investing in property and having it become sort of like passive is also like investing in the right property, because you know, yes. Like I've stayed in properties that were like, you know, luxury, and they were like for 4 years. Like I think I called the, you know, like I was renting, and I think I called the, I didn't call really. I messaged the property manager like twice over something, and that was like it, you know, like in 4 years. But I'm a great tenant, like really, I am. And most people, I think, wouldn't be. But I would say like investing in the right property is like a great aspect of that. Like, you know, the condition of it, you think, okay, a lot of people like invest in properties that need to be done up, but then perhaps don't think about the fact that a lot of those kind of properties will need a lot of upkeep. And yes. Tell me about choosing the right property to invest in.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Lily. From the beginning, you know, trying to get a bad performing property in a less desirable area or a high crime area, it makes it hard to attract tenants because they don't want to be there. You know, in some of our underperforming properties, or some of the properties in the portfolio in these high crime areas, that owners were like, hey, we're struggling to fill this place, can you guys help us out? And we did, but it's hard to rent because people would rather live in a safer place, a place with great schools. And I always just kind of frame it as desirability. If it's a desirable area, that's a perfect place to invest. And one of the easiest ways to note that is, where are the good schools? And you can find that data on Public anywhere across the country. We only do stuff in Houston, but if you're looking anywhere across the country, look where people want to hang out. And if you're targeting families, or that's your demographic for that type of property, look at the schools. Those two things right there will attract great tenants. When you attract great tenants, that's leads to, you know, usually a great experience. And like you mentioned, we see about 2 to 3 maintenance requests per property per year. So the odds of you having a flood of maintenance is pretty low, unless, as you mentioned, somebody does a poor job of fixing up the property, or they buy a really dilapidated property thinking that they're just going to put lipstick on a pig, put somebody in there, and everything's going to be peachy keen. Not in this environment. Maybe 10 years ago when we were in a supply shortage of housing, but now that we're seeing inventories levels rise, there's a lot of competition. And the way you stand out is by having a desirable property that's fixed up and maintained that people want to be in.
Thank you. Tell me a little bit more about finding the right tenant, because you mentioned a little bit. And one thing I've discovered is that for a long time, I was renting out to people that tended to be between 20 and 30 in that bracket. And what I noticed is they were moving a lot. And what I was doing as an extra for them is that I was helping them kind of like redo their CV, so they would like find a job. And I was renting to people that didn't have a job oftentimes. And I know that's like, that's not what people tend to do like in the rental world, but that's what I was doing. And what I noticed is that they were staying anywhere between like 6 months and 3 years. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed is as I grew kind of older, I don't know how, but I kind of mirrored my age into the tenants. So like I was attracting the same type of tenants as my age, and I'm 44 now. And what I've discovered is that the people that are kind of like older in the like 35 to 45 kind of bracket, they tend to be a lot more stable in terms of like income, in terms of like not moving around as much. They're kind of set in their ways and they like to kind of stay in the same place, and they tend to like keep the property a lot better. They tend to be cleaner. They tend to be like more organized. They tend to be more less babyish, you know, like, because, you know, like the people in the 20 to 30 kind of bracket, they tend to like, they need babysitting a lot. It's like, you know, oh, this one said this and this one is like, you know, talking after midnight. They're not able to like talk to each other and kind of, you know, when you're kind of renting to people in like houses in multiple occupation, I'm not sure what you call those in flat shares and, you know, house shares. I find that the people that are kind of like older, they tend to be a lot more mature. It's kind of a lot easier to manage them. So how do you find those kind of people? Like, and even how do you decide what kind of bracket, like age group or target market in terms of like jobs or like, or is it just you kind of like target everyone and like hope for the best, and then you look at their references and you kind of hope for the best? Or what's your strategy for finding really great tenants that will look after the property?
Yeah, no. And that is the lead domino. Outside of getting a property that's, if you've got an attractive or a desirable property, the next best thing or the next thing to do is make sure you put a quality tenant in there, someone that's not going to tear it up. So that's, you're thinking about this the exact right way. The tenant screening. So ideally, we would have maybe somebody that lives by themselves, that's a mature adult, or a couple with no kids, and they would be the least destructive and they would stay for 10 to 15 years and everybody would be happy. But the reality is we can't discriminate based on familial status. So I get owners that come to me that say, listen, I don't want any kids or I don't want any pets. And it's like, well, what happens about service animals and ESA pets? What happens about, we can't discriminate based on familial status. We can't say no kids or no college students. So what we do, and I own a couple student rentals in Ohio, and I can tell you, you're 100% right. The kids, some of them have trouble. They have really never done a load of laundry. So they pour all the detergent, or they think that, you know, half the gallon jug of detergent is what you need to put in for one load. So I've seen overrun dishwashers, overrun washing machines. I mean, you wouldn't believe that a lot of them have very little skills. And I guess, you know, at 18, 19 years old, you don't expect them to do much. But yeah, it can be a lot more time intensive dealing with 18 to 22 year olds or kids that are just coming out of school. But what we'll do is we have qualifications that screen based on income, based on rental history, based on eviction rate, criminal history. And then we also look at their pets. We even screen their pets, Lily. We make sure that, hey, does Fluffy have any sort of training? When has Fluffy bitten anybody? Is Fluffy up on their vaccination records? And you look at that whole picture, and then you can kind of get a risk profile from the pet perspective and then the people perspective. But basically, when you're looking at job history, you're looking at income, you're looking at the criminal activity and whether they have been evicted or not. And that's how we'll usually judge. Now, kids that just come out of school, usually they don't have a lot of rental history. And so we'll allow a co-signer to come on. So typically we see a lot better behavior when mom and dad are co-signing for the property. That helps out. Or it could be anybody that co-signs for tenants that don't have a lot of rental history. And then we also do things with deposits. So if somebody has a super low credit score, you know, we like to see everything above a 620. But if you see that it come down, we'll typically add in maybe a deposit and a half or a double deposit, depending upon that. So there's a way to kind of reduce or offset that risk. And Lily, we have screened thousands of tenants, and every year we look at the problem tenants that we had, those that couldn't pay rent, those that we had to evict, and we change those qualifications. So we're looking at all that data and we're making judgments. And today, currently, we evict less than 8 out of every 1,000 tenants we place. So we have a really good, robust process, and we collect between 98 and 99% of rents every month. So, you know, the system that we're designing and have designed, you know, it works. And it's really a lot of basic stuff, Lily, like you were mentioning, just like the income, making sure that the tenant has the means and ability to pay. And if there are any red flags, like they had a drug dealing charge or they had a violent charge with, you know, a gun or some sort of theft or something like that, that, you know, that's probably indicative of a tenant that you probably don't want to live next to.
Thank you. You're mentioning so many troubles. Like, I've never heard of these things.
That's probably a good thing. That's probably a really good thing.
Okay. So in terms of creating passive income with property rentals, tell me what you mean by you think most landlords are running their rentals wrong.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the hobby thing. I think that owners look at that and rental property owners, and they say, hey, if the rent's coming in, I'm good. Well, what if you're bringing in $2,000 a month and the market rent's $2,500? What happens if this tenant is not bothering you and just leaving you alone because they're destroying the house? Are you doing annual inspections to make sure that property, your asset, is being preserved? We've had owners who come to us typically when there's a problem, right? If they have an occupied property with a tenant in place, they're coming to us because the tenant's not paying rent, they've destroyed it, they've thrown out mold, attorney, and the owners are scared. So they come over to us and say, hey, can you fix this problem? And we've seen everything from, again, mold, lawsuits, tenants who are 4 to 6 months behind on rent, and they come over to us. So, and again, I think it goes back to making sure you set expectations up front, get a solid lease agreement, make sure that that tenant understands that, and that you are treating this as a business and not a hobby, not just, hey, it's mailbox money. As long as the tenant doesn't call me, I'm never going to check on the property. I'm never going to bother them. I don't want to hear from them. Instead, taking a proactive approach, designing a strategy. And that's what we help a lot of investors with. Come up with your strategy. You know, what is your investing strategy? And being proactive to answer and contact that tenant, not just when rent's late, saying, hi, Mr. and Mrs. Tenant, I noticed it's your birthday, just wanted to send you a $10 Starbucks gift card. Stuff like that goes a long, long way. Or just saying, hey, I made a note in here, maybe you knew there were anniversary. We have a little fund that we use every month to send one tenant or one owner or something. And we knew that one of the new owners coming on board just had a child. So we sent them something like that. You can do the exact same thing with a tenant. Just being proactive, building a relationship with the tenant so it's not super transactional. And, you know, just trying to make it so you're not ignoring it and trying to be passive by just ignoring everything, just stepping back. Being passive is having a plan, executing on that plan, nipping things in the bud quickly, and then you slowly build passive income that way.
Thank you. What's the best way to reduce vacancy? Because for me, I noticed that for many years, I was renting out at any time because like there are so many people that wanted to rent. And what I noticed is after a while, although I was increasing the rentals and I thought I was making profit, okay? But what happened is like during the summer, I had like maybe 1 or 2 months of vacancy. And then like when, you know, especially after Brexit, you know, like before Brexit, no, there was no vacancy. And even there were people that, let's say, wanted to move in on Friday and I had the property available for Wednesday. And I would be like, no, I'm going to look for someone for Wednesday. Like it was, you know, so good before Brexit. But after Brexit, I noticed some rooms were getting empty and I was unwilling to reduce the price because often I noticed not great tenants were coming like for the summer somehow. And so I would, if you look at the bigger picture, I would lose out on the actual rental. So I noticed actually after a long, long, long time that it's best to actually rent September to September. And if you do it this way, you find like the best tenants that tend to stay not just 1 year, but they can stay 5 years, they can stay 3 years. And, you know, doing it randomly, doing it at the worst times, like renting in March or in April or in May, you know, you could end up with someone who might just stay much less than their contract says, or they might be just like not a great tenant, or they might be a troublemaker, or, you know, that's been my experience. A lot of the time when I was renting in the summer, it was not like the best experience. So tell me about timing and reducing vacancy.
Yeah. And so in Houston or in the States in general, there are typically it's Q4. That would be a tip for everybody in the States. Q4 is a bad time to have a property to come up vacant or to have a property, a lease end in November, October, November, December. And the reason for that being is we have Thanksgiving holiday in November. It's typically cold. Even if you're in the southern part of the country, it can be very cold. And usually the weather's not great. And then you have Christmas in December and New Year's. So people are traveling. Maybe it's winter break for colleges. People are out and about. Or the weather's so crappy, especially in the northern part of the country, the weather's so crappy that people don't want to go out and look at stuff when it's, you know, pouring rain or cold or 40 degrees and it's snowing like a blizzard. So we see extended vacancy times if a property ever comes up for rent October, November, December. So Q4, don't have your leases. Like you said, the latest we'd like to end leases is September. And the other thing is, so our busy season, the peak time is March, April, May. So right as traditionally it follows the school schedule. So when kids get out of school, that's when you see the demand come up for rental properties because people don't want to move while their kids are in school. And even if you don't have kids, that's just, you know, a lot of people have families and they're waiting till the kids graduate or the kids get out and then they'll move in the summer. So that's when we see demand come up and then we see it slowly trickle off August, September, and then it troughs, goes to the bottom November and December. So if you can hit that time, March, April, May, that's the best time for us in greater Houston area. And so that's one thing. So making sure if you start a lease, even if you're in October, it just came that way where you found a good deal in October, November, try to get your lease, either do it like a 14-month lease to get it in January, February, or do a lesser lease to have it in September, whichever one you want. That's number one. Number two, we're going to say something?
No.
Oh, sorry. Number two, I would make sure that you coordinate everything you need to do when a tenant vacates. So we do a 60-day notice. We require a 60-day notice from all of our tenants. So we have plenty of time to know, okay, this tenant's going to be out at the end of May. We're going to plan right now. We're already getting the rekey set up. We're already getting the property inspection. We're already getting utilities set up. So that way it's a smooth process. It's not, okay, the tenant's out. Now what do we do? Now what, you know, what's the next thing we do? And we wait around and you burn days. And on average, you're losing about $100 a day. In some areas, it's a little more. In some areas, it's a little less. But you can say on average, you're going to lose about $100 a day when that property sits vacant. So that's the other thing, timing. And then, you know, one other thing that we could talk about is making sure you price the property appropriately from the beginning. So if you have got this property set up and ready, rent ready in a peak demand, that's ideal. And then you had all your coordination, everything done. So you reduce the vacancy on that front. Those are two things you're going to be ahead of half of just mom and pop investors. But the third thing is making sure you price the property appropriately from the beginning. So as soon as that property comes on market, making sure that that price is the best price. You got great pictures. It's a great presentation of the property because new research from Rent Engine, which is a company that's got tens of thousands of rental listings in the States, they said that one third, 31% of all the resident leads you're going to get happen in the first 7 days. So that means that if you want to come in and say, I'm going to try to get $3,000 a month for my property, let's just see. I'm going to be comfortable with $2,800 or $2,700, but I just want to try to get $3,000. If you wait 7 days and do that price drop on day eight, you have missed one third of all your prospects.
That is so interesting. Tell me more about creating passive income with property rentals. What I mean is, for example, when I was a lot younger, I had a landlord and he basically didn't want to deal with me, you know? So he was like, I'll give you cheap rent. Don't call mm-hmm. me for anything. And he gave me like a really, like a rundown kind of property. So mm-hmm. like I invested £5,000 into it, like to create, furniture, and change the flooring and a lot of different things. And he kind of expected that, you know? And I lived there for 8 years and I never called him for anything. Like if the fridge broke or if the whatever broke, whatever, I just like bought stuff. Yeah. And tell me, is that like a good strategy for someone who wants to have passive income with their property rentals if they don't want to have like an actual property manager to have like cheap someone who is like potentially a good tenant? Or do you recommend doing something else that is better? Or is it better to like hire someone like you and just like maximize the rentals and still it works out better in the long term, paying you and getting higher rental and basically doing it like this.
Yeah, I think there are times, and listen, like, it sounds like you were a great tenant and that worked out and you didn't call the your landlord for years. However, what I have seen is owners do the same thing, and it is a strategy. Hey, if the property is going to rent at $2,000 a month, I'm going to lease it at $1,800 and I don't want to hear from you. I'm going to lease it at $1,700 and Mr. and Mrs. Tenant, don't call me for anything. I'm not going to fix anything. I'm not making any improvements and I'm not going to raise the rent. Okay, fine. However, the tenant attracts in certain situations is one that is probably not going to take care of the property. You're probably not presenting a good property to begin with. And so the tenant that's going to come in and start destroying stuff, you're probably going to have a really problem property when you get the property back or when that tenant moves out. The other thing is you really don't know what kind of condition that tenant is going to, how that tenant is going to take care of that property. So what are the repairs that they're going to do? If there's a leak in the ceiling and the tenant goes, landlord told me not to call anybody. Well, it might be a little drip right now and not too much of a problem, but then it becomes a major issue. It keeps dripping. It creates mold. The ceiling falls in. And now now you're going to call your landlord and you're going to be upset. And I think that's kind of what happens, right? It's like, don't call me for anything. Fine. And then these small things become big things. Or, you know, we've had people who call us about sparks. They plug in something. They have their toaster oven in. They have all these things on the countertop. And they got a toaster oven and an air fryer and their hair dryer. And, you know, then you get a spark out of the outlet. If you got a property where the expectation is you don't call the landlord, that could be something that could, you know, result in a house fire or something very serious too. So I don't recommend that. It can work for certain landlords, especially in problem properties or in properties that are a little maybe in the less desirable areas. But we have found that if you do a solid turnover and make that property as desirable as possible, do nice finishes, take care of the property, respond to the tenant, that creates an environment where the tenant then takes some pride of ownership and they take care of the property. So when they move out in 3, 4, or 5 years, and our tenants stay on average 3 to 4 years, then, you know, you typically get the property with a little bit of wear and tear and it's not too bad. That to me, if you can get market rent, do the little fixes that come up from, you know, every now and then, you know, a couple times a year, to me that protects the asset and you have less of those one-off things, leaks, you know, sparks that come up that really can hurt your asset value or create $5, $10, $15, $20,000 expenses, which can really hurt your cash flow.
Thank you. Tell me about house rules. And is it, for example, in your standard operating procedure that you have like some sort of house rules that are typed up, turned into a PDF manual of some sort? And is that kind of thing available for the tenants? Like, this is something I don't have, but I do find that, you know, I went to a course, a property course, and there was a guy who kind of talked about it and I saw the kind of things that he had included. And I thought about it, you know, like if there's like a serious problem, like, you know, like a big leak that kind of comes up in the middle of the night and nobody knows like where the water stopping thingy is or the, you know, like a lot of emergencies can happen where you're actually not available and they have to figure it out. And oftentimes, you know, you can have great smart tenants and you can have people that don't have common sense and some people that don't speak English as well. So you could end up with a massive problem. And then the thing is you're liable for that. Like if anything happens to them, like it's on you. You know, like you could end up in a lot of trouble. So tell me about how do you manage like the house rules so that you don't end up in a lot of trouble and prevent issues?
So we do a move-in call. So with our resident services associate, that tenant, and you can do this as an owner, you can do this anytime, going through the lease, making sure they understand when rent is due, when late fees kick in. Our lease is like 16 or 17 pages and people just sign it. They don't read the whole thing. They just sign it. So we want to make sure like, you know, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Tenant, do you understand this is when rent's due? These are when late fees kick in. This is the acceptable means and how you make payment. And we just walk through the basics. But the other thing we do with that, so one, we set the expectation with the lease. But number two is we also talk about where the water shutoff valve is. So if there is a leak and they call us. Now we have a 24/7 maintenance line and a tenant portal for maintenance requests, but you never know. If they need to go in there and shut the water off quickly, we make sure they know that up front. The other thing that we make sure they know is where the breaker box is. So the electrical panel, when you plug in something and then your toaster, you know, again, goes out and you're like, oh my gosh, you go over the breaker and you flip that. Knowing where those two things are in your property for the tenant, making sure the tenant knows that, can save you so many maintenance requests. We see about 1/3 of our maintenance requests are troubleshoot. We either troubleshoot them with our team, and they're small stuff. Hitting the reset button on a garbage disposal, making sure that you flip the breaker, knowing where something is, and just being able to tell the tenant or send them a YouTube video. We can cancel about 1/3. We cancel all of about 1/3 of our maintenance requests. So setting those expectations up front with the water valve, the breaker box, and the lease. The lease should spell out who changes the AC filters. How do you have a water softener system? Is that supposed to be on there? So that's the stuff we do in a move-in call. So we make sure that we handle that right from the get-go. How are they going to get access to the property? How do they submit maintenance? How do they pay rent? All that stuff we lay out in the move-in call, Lily. And that's kind of the house rules thing, but we also have that on our website as well. So we have the move-in call, we talk to them with that, and then we put it on their portal. And then they have, you know, like a move-in checklist, a move-out checklist on the website that they can always reference.
Thank you. One thing that is like a recurring maintenance request is the boiler losing pressure. Is that something mm-hmm. that you have like a standard operating procedure for, like how to raise it back up, or you just like get the maintenance person in?
Yeah, I think it depends. I'm not 100% familiar with the boilers. We have gas or electric hot water tanks here. And so those are pretty easy to relight the pilot light. And we'll just send, we have the template. We found a great YouTube video. We have that, and we send it over to the tenants when they need it. If it comes in, we have our maintenance coordinator trained that when it comes in that the hot water tank is having an issue, they send them that video, they go in, they light it, and it's all good. If the tenant doesn't feel comfortable, like, you know, maybe you have a tenant that's in their 80s or 90s and they're great tenants, but they're just not really handy, well, then we'll go and we'll send somebody out to help with it. But most of the time, we just want tenants doing basic stuff. You don't want tenants doing plumbing, electrical. And it kind of goes back to that thing that you were talking about with lowering rent just to not have to deal with it. That tenant might get crazy and decide, hey, I want to paint this whole place. I'm going to redo the electrical. And now you have, you know, you might be spending thousands of dollars to undo the damage, and the security deposit might just not pay for that.
Thank you. I want to know where you find these 80 and 90 year old tenants.
I had somebody in their 70s. They've been great tenants, but their daughter had to help them sign the lease electronically. There was a lot of stuff there, but they've been great tenants.
Thank you. Another issue that comes up a lot is actually the, you know, like when you wash your clothes and then you forget your coins and your, hair clips and stuff like that in the washing machine. Like, do you have like standard operating procedures for all of the different things that could possibly go wrong that are recurring issues, and you kind of like deal with them like this?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, exactly. So when a tenant submits a maintenance request, our maintenance coordinator will look at that request and go, okay, I've been trained. Is this on one of the 7 to 10 things that I've been trained on or the items? And if it's something that we can troubleshoot, and again, making it just basic stuff, like I use that example because it's just so common, just going in and flipping the breaker, hit the reset button on the GFCI outlet, just little stuff like that. That's the stuff that we have lined out. And if it's going to be something a little more complex, that's when we get a vendor involved. But any routine maintenance, water softeners, HVAC assessments, we have a standard SOP for that, or we have a vendor that's going to take care of that. And so, yeah, we try to head that a lot of that off, Lily, in the beginning to make sure that the tenant, the worst thing that can happen is a tenant moves into a property and they immediately start having maintenance problems. It just creates a negative experience for the rest of the 11, 12, 13 months that they're going to be there. So we want to make sure that this property is in as good of a condition as it can be so that the tenant has as many months as possible without putting in a maintenance request or without having to, for us to dispatch somebody and spend money.
Thank you. The other issue that I noticed when I was in the US, okay, is that let's say an Amazon delivery person will drop off your package and they will leave it in front of the house. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like people can take that, you know? And yeah. I'm wondering, like, how do you manage that to make sure that there's no recurring issues of theft of Amazon packages and deliveries and things like that?
Well, you're not going to like the answer, but the answer is we tell them if they have any theft that they need to call 911. And that absolves us of a lot of responsibility, but that also absolves the owner. So if you're an owner and you just have one property and, you know, you never know. The tenant could be calling and saying, hey, they stole this package, they stole that. And really, they're sitting in their car or they've used them. So we just say like, hey, you need to protect your personal property. We've had issues with tenants who are calling in about a neighbor. It's like, listen, if they're doing something that makes you feel unsafe, you need to call 911. You need to call the police and file a report. We try to stay out of those domestic disputes because if we don't manage that other property across the street, there's not much we can do. And tenants can be just like anybody, you know, they can bend the truth, right? So one person says, no, they did this. The other person says they did it, does that. We are not licensed counselors or therapists. So we stay out of that. We let the police handle it. And that seems to, you know, handle things the right way.
Thank you. What other techniques do you have for people to create a truly passive income with property rentals and hassle-free?
Yeah, I think building a team as well, making sure that if you're not going to hire a property manager, and I did it myself when I first started. And I think with a couple properties, it makes the most sense unless you're super busy or have to move or you're not really handy or you're not, you know, able to tell somebody that says, I can't pay rent, you need to pay and follow the process. If you're not a stern person, then it probably is best to outsource that. But if you can build a team of people, you build a lease agent to help you lease the properties and take professional pictures and make that presentation all nice. And then you find a couple good vendors to handle little small things like a handyman, just small little items, somebody that can do that. Some, you know, person that can handle bigger stuff, maybe the plumbing and electrical. If you can build a team of those people, then that will make truly passive because I did that when I first started. So after I realized, man, I am calling people all the time for carpeting replacement or luxury vinyl plank. So I just found a guy and then he was my guy and he was my guy until he wasn't my guy. And then I found a new guy and that, you know, you get a problem. Cool. You go over to Efren, you go over to Carlos, you go over to these guys that we had and you just had a guy for each situation. So I don't know if you're familiar with the book, Who Now by Dean Jackson. And I think is Darren Hardy, but he talks about in that as, You don't need the how. You don't need to understand how to do it. You need a who. And the who could be a property manager, or it could be all these other individuals that are throughout the process of helping you get that property leased. And that, once you have a team of those people, just like if you're in corporate and you have a team of people that report to you, that reduces your workload. Now it just becomes managing these people. And that's when it gets truly passive, asymmetric from your time involved.
Thank you. What's the best way to find a really good power team that will take most of your hassles away?
I think referrals are always the big one. You know, that's an easy place. Just like if you know people that are investing in the area, go ask them. If you have friends that are investing as well, ask them. The second best place, honestly, Bigger Pockets is free. And that is a huge platform with like over 1 million real estate investors. You can poke around there. If you're looking for handymen and maintenance folks, going to new construction sites, just driving through there and checking out the trucks. Sometimes they'll have little, you know, the numbers or the logo on the trucks. Going to Home Depot or Lowe's at early in the morning, seeing whose vehicles are there early, 6, 7 o'clock, right when they open. The people that are planning their day out and then going, you don't want to go there at 9 or 10 when the people, you know, are basically poor planners and they're going there in the middle of the day. You want to hit the people that go there early. And I think that's the main ones, you know, looking at Google reviews, if they do have it, making sure that, you know, these folks have a history. I see one thing that I hate it. It's when new investors or somebody with one or two properties goes out and hires somebody that's really inexperienced because they're cheap. And they say, okay, I'm going to go with this person. I'm going to give them a shot. Well, you're going to pay for their education, because they're not going to have all the tricks of the trade that some of us have been doing 10 or 20 years. No. And so I think being mindful that maybe somebody is super nice and they're super hardworking, but going with somebody that's super experienced. Don't go with the handyman that just started his business 1 year ago. Go with the guy that's been doing it 10 and 20 years. It's maybe in a family business. Don't go with the real estate or leasing agent that is just starting. They're leaving their corporate job and they want to come into this. Go with the person who's done 100, 200 of the deals that you're looking for. And that's a way to build a really great team. You can. Just seen it work out very poorly, because you're going to end up paying for the education of that new person. And they're not going to do as good of a job as a more experienced individual. And that new person, just like I did when I started, I didn't know what I didn't know. I thought I was doing a really good job. And then, then you get more experience. You're like, oh my gosh, that was so dumb of me. I didn't even know that. And then you learn, and then you make, you make your process improvements and you go on from there. But Lily, build a team of experienced people. That is huge and paramount.
Thank you. Where can property investors connect with you?
The easiest way is just going on our website, emersonpropertymanagement.com, and we have our socials up there, LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, and whatnot.
Thank you.
Follow me for more property wealth strategies.